We are in this class discussing the Gospel of Mark, using as our basis a relatively new commentary on Mark written by Ched Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, entitled Binding the Strong Man. How many of you are new today? Not here before. Oh, a whole bunch of you. I'll say a little bit about what Myers is trying to do in this commentary. But before doing that, I think I'd like to have Charles, who's staying from the class before, introduce these maps that are up here in front of us. They belong to him. Could you do that? Tell us about your maps.
My maps.
We have a map of Palestine here that is probably different than most of them you've seen, because this looks like Palestine's lying on its side. East is, well, you talk about it.
Yeah. This is a different perspective. Usually you see maps of Palestine north and south. This one goes as if you're flying an airplane from, let's say, Rome into Jaffa, coming from the west to the east. And the advantage of this map is, first of all, I have lots of blue space here to put lots of writing for the Mediterranean Sea. But I think also it gives you a better perspective of what Israel looks like coming from the west to the east. I still have to struggle of why, but... And I have another companion map that goes with this. It's a satellite map of Israel as it would look as if you were in a satellite. I'm not quite sure how many miles up in the air. I said 300. That may be an exaggeration. But you're looking down upon Israel from perspective from a very high location. And every time you see black, that would indicate water, and red is vegetation. And you'll also notice that on the map we have yellow arrows that have numbers inside of them with a letter. And the letter and the numbers refer to posters that I have that are blown up from here of what those areas actually look like. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I have these two maps, the satellite maps, part one and part two, is on the table for you to look at.
John, would you bring that other one up here, please?
This goes from
full scope of this.
This goes from Galilee. This is the Sea of Galilee here. Again, you're going from.
Just put your hand there.
You're going from east to.
I'll be in the way.
Okay.
I don't know where to stand.
That's okay. You're going from east to west again. Here's Capernaum. And if you look very closely, even on a satellite map, you still see little ruins of Capernaum, which is the headquarters of the disciples. And then there's a little letter and number that you look down here at this. And it actually gives you a picture of what it actually looks like. And Verlin and I were thinking of an idea of getting a computer. You know, you got these computer airports, and actually having has come into Capernaum in different places that would, but then somebody in the last class said they've already done that in Egypt already with the pyramids, block on the pyramids. So, I hope this doesn't take away from the imagination of what you would hope that Israel would look like in your mind's eye. This is pretty realistic. And again, I think there's still a better perspective going from west to east rather than north to south, because you get a view across. We have to look in the distance otherwise. And I guess that's it. And one other perspective on this too is take a look from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is about 17 miles, to give you an idea of how far that is. And that's approximately from here, let's say, to Chelan. Give you an idea of the distance of the Good Samaritan route.
And you were saying, Charles, that if you go from Jerusalem to Jericho, you go down 3,000, how much elevation?
3,000 feet.
3,000 feet from Jerusalem to Jericho.
Which may not be that much different here.
that's the road in which the Good Samaritan parable supposedly takes place.
And I do have blown up posters of section 1, section 2, section 3, section 4. It's at about this height, about this wide. They do have those available. So I could come in here with those four posters from here to the beyond that post over there of Israel looks like. For those who are
that right. Is that map available anywhere?
Oh yeah. You know? Dr. Benz from Wartburg Seminary has those available.
Okay.
And who knows, they might leave them out here.
Very useful in parish education and churches. Have others have seen this map before? I'd never seen this before. Very interesting. Some of you have been in Israel, I presume. So you know this firsthand. I have not been there. Have you been there, John?
I've been there. No. It gives you a perspective. I'm glad I went, but now that I've been there, I don't know if I want to go back again. I'm glad I've seen it. Maybe the action is here at home.
Jesus wouldn't want us to go, really, would he?
Pardon me?
Jesus doesn't want us to go back there. He wants us in Capernaum. He wants us out here. Right?
This is Daddy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the things we want to see about the Gospel of Mark, and this is also true in Matthew and Luke, is that the story is divided into two parts. Chet Myers, our commentary we're following, calls it Book 1 and Book 2. The first book takes place in Galilee, the northern part of Palestine. Let's not get our directions confused. This is north. This is south. The northern part of Palestine, where Jesus came from. Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee. Matthew and Luke tell us that he was born in Bethlehem, of course, but his home is in Nazareth in Galilee. And the second book takes place in Judea. And the section that we supposedly are dealing with today, which I've labeled On the Way, is the journey from Galilee to Jerusalem, which Jesus appears to take, according to Mark's account, with very great intentionality, that he's going to Jerusalem for what purpose?
To die.
To die, to be on the cross. It's the way of the cross that's being walked on the way in the central chapters of Mark. Since we have a number of new people, I think we do need to review a little bit. We're desperately behind what the schedule announced on the kiosk.
We're only on verse 3, everybody.
What we're going to try to do today is to summarize a whole bunch of stuff. So hang on. But what I think I need to say for those of you who are new is that the commentary written by Chet Myers suggests that Mark lived in Galilee, that Mark, the writer of the gospel, whoever he was, we call him Mark, was a part of a community, a rural community with a strong, as he put it, anti-city bias, and that this community sought to model out, to witness to, a vision of a new kind of world which was totally different than the world of that day. Different because it wanted to, its vision was a vision of equality among people, male and female, women not to be subverted by men, as was very much the case in the ancient world, even more so than today. Equality between Jews and Gentiles, between the rich and the poor, adults and children. There will be no oppressed people, as is true in every society. One person after class last time suggested that I ought to introduce as an analogy for our day the relationship between heterosexual people and gay and lesbian people to illustrate how radical was the vision that this community had. A lot of people in our society cannot tolerate the notion that gay people are equal to heterosexual people. the reason why we have a problem with gay people being in the military or gay people being ordained in the ELCA is not a problem with gay people, it's a problem with the heterosexual people. The problem is in the attitude of the majority toward the minority. Just as in the South during the time of Martin Luther King, the problem was not the black people, the problem was white racism. The problem in South Africa today, in apartheid, is not a problem with black people, it's a problem with white people. It's the attitude of the people in power toward the marginalized or the oppressed. And that's the part of the warp and woof of our culture and our society around the world. And it was true in Palestine, in ancient Palestine. And the vision that Mark is calling people to is a vision that would overthrow all of the forces that are oppressive of anybody else. But not violently. This community is committed to a revolution, but a revolution that's nonviolent. Committed to a revolution, as Myers puts it, from the ground up. And he sees that in the parable of the mustard seed, where Jesus makes the point that the seed grows gradually. We need patience with that. It's not going to happen overnight. The revolution happens gradually. But it will happen. That seed will grow. The term that's used in Greek is automate, from which we get our word automatically. The seed grows of itself. And we make a mistake if we try to coerce that seed into growing more rapidly, as happens in an armed revolution, where you seek to overthrow a power with the military force. That is not the way the revolution is to happen. But the revolution will happen. The message of those same parables is a message of hope. This little community up in Galilee was always in danger of disintegrating, because people would get tired, they'd get weary, they'd burn out, and they'd defect, and the danger was always there of informers on the inside. This is a community that's under constant threat and lives with great fear and great risk, the fear of death continuously. And what happened when Judas betrayed Jesus is a symbol of the kind of betrayal that this community always felt itself in danger of experiencing. We need, if we're going to read Mark, Myers is saying, we need to have a very strong sense of how volatile the situation was that Mark is addressing. And he portrays Jesus as calling the disciples into that community. But he's not calling those disciples into a nice, cozy community where everybody's going to be nice and safe, serving tea at Ladies' Aid. You know, that's not the image. What he's calling the disciples into is death. He's calling the disciples into on the way to the cross, to death. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, want to be seated, one on the right hand side and one on the left hand side, when you come into your glory, huh? Jesus is going to go to Jerusalem to be a king, son of David, mount the throne, rule Israel, overthrow the Romans. And Jesus said, that ain't the way it's going to be. You ain't got it yet. You haven't caught on yet to what I'm talking about. That's not what Messiah means. A lot of Hebrew people thought that's what Messiah meant. That was the prevailing notion of what the Messiah would be. But Jesus takes that word Messiah and he turns it upside down. In fact, he doesn't even want him to say Messiah because it's so misleading. He uses the term Son of Man, or Human One, as Myers translates it, to get away from the male language. Son of Man, which is a term from the book of Daniel that was associated in Hebrew thought with the Messiah. But it's a different picture of the Messiah. It's a picture of the Messiah as the suffering servant in 2nd Isaiah, Isaiah 51, 52, 53. Not the Messiah who will be the king, the son of David, the Lord of Lords, as most people thought. And you notice when in chapter 8, the beginning of book 2, when Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter responds, he's the one that always talked first. What did he say?
"You are the Christ."
"You are the Christ," which means in Hebrew, you are
the Messiah.
The Messiah. You go to the head of the class, Peter. A plus. You passed your catechetics. However, then what happened? Then Jesus, not using the word Messiah, but using the term Son of Man, the Son of Man, the human one, is now going to start walking toward Jerusalem. And there he will be apprehended by the elders, the Jewish authorities, by the Romans, the Roman authorities, the powers, and he will be what? Killed. He will be killed. And what's Peter's response to that?
"Don't go."
"No way, Jesus. No way is that going to happen. That is not what's supposed to happen to the Messiah." And what does Jesus say to Peter?
"Get back at me, Satan."
"Hey, look, you have not gotten the message, Peter. Top of the class to the bottom of the class. Back of me. You're on the side, not of God, but of Satan, in this apocalyptic war of myths that Myers says underlies the whole Markan story. Jesus pit against the forces of Satan, met in the wilderness in the very first chapter, the temptation story, which Mark summarizes in one sentence, Matthew and Luke dependent on Mark, enlarge it with the three temptations, which incidentally are not in the same order as in Matthew as they are in Mark, or Luke. The battle between Jesus and forces of evil is played out again and again and again in this story. And he's saying, Messiah, don't use that word. Let's not use that word anymore. That word's confusing. Let's not use that term anymore. And Jesus never identifies himself as a Messiah in the Gospel. But he uses the word Son of Man, which always has this connotation of being the one who will suffer, who will die. But that message the disciples have trouble understanding. So Myers suggests that throughout this book you have the issue raised of sight and hearing. And we see how that grows as we move through Mark. It begins very early with the inability of the disciples to understand. And Jesus, in the seventh chapter or eighth chapter, talks about the disciples' hearts having been hardened. He uses, with reference to the disciples, the same language which in an earlier chapter he uses of the scribes. The scribes' hearts were hardened. They didn't understand. And now he says that of the disciples. And as we move through the Gospel of Mark, we see how that becomes more and more an issue. Ted Myers suggests that the parable of the sower that appears in chapter 4 is the parable of the whole story of the Gospel of Mark. The problem of the witness to a new vision, the message, the evangel, the gospel, as most of it falling on non-productive soil. Not because there was something wrong with the gospel, not because the vision was unclear, but because the people weren't ready to hear it. The hardening of the hearts. And even the disciples themselves, who were closest to Jesus, were unable to understand, were not able to comprehend what Jesus was saying, because it was too revolutionary. It was too contrary to what they themselves were bringing into that conversation. And they were not open enough to hear. And if you read in Mark, listen for the big words, as I suggested the other day. And one of the things that you tune your mind to is how many times the term listen, pay attention, wake up, that kind of language, over and over in Mark. Wake up, listen, open your ears. You have ears but you can't hear, you have eyes but you can't see. You're just not understanding. You're not getting it. Over and over again in Mark. And then along with that is the exorcism stories that appear over and over again, where the evil spirits are driven out. And as I said last time, Myers suggests that the question really for us is not so much, were in fact these people possessed by spirits? Were in fact evil spirits driven out by Jesus? Was this in fact an exorcism? We're more inclined in our scientific world to think of demon possession as mental illness or some such thing as that. And we think we understand mental illness. The truth of the matter is we don't understand mental illness either. We put a label on it and we think we understand it. We put schizophrenia on a set of symptoms and then we think we understand it. And we have a certain medications that we can match up with those symptoms, and that gives us the mythology that we understand. But we really don't understand. We don't understand mental illness today. We may have a better understanding of it than the ancient world did, but for the people in the ancient world, demon possession was very commonplace. Nobody in Mark's day would question the possibility of demon possession. Nobody would question the accuracy of these stories that Jesus drove out of a demon. Nobody would question that. That's something we question. They didn't question that. But Myers makes the point that there were lots of exorcists in the ancient world. There were lots of magicians. There were lots of wonder workers. There were lots of people doing what Jesus was doing. What Jesus was doing in exorcising the demons was not unusual. It certainly is not proof that Jesus was more powerful than anybody else was. Or that it's not a proof that Jesus was the Son of God or divine or anything like that. That's not the issue in those stories. And Myers says, why is it that when there were so many people that were doing exorcisms, why is it that Jesus' exorcism creates such a stir, such a crisis, becomes so alarming to people? Why is that? It's because there's a lot more going on there than the people realized. What's going on there is the apocalyptic war of myths, is Jesus' encounter with the forces of oppression and evil, and we need to read it on a political level. And what the symbolic meaning of those stories, Myers' term, symbolic meaning of those stories, is Jesus pitting himself against the forces of evil that are oppressive of people. The forces of the Romans, the word legion symbolizes the Roman forces, the forces of Jewish power oppressing people, Jewish religious leadership, the violent forces of that day is what Jesus was pitting himself against and driving out of that culture. A symbol of the dramatic revolution that Jesus was up to, in which the Markan community was trying to model out. Now, I hope for those of you who were not here before, that gives you some sense of the perspective that Ched Myers is taking on the gospel. And it is it's a perspective I assume is quite different from what most of us have been raised on, certainly what I've been raised on. And I said the other day, I introduced this to you not as the way to read Mark, but as a way to read Mark. and invite you to get into that way of thinking, because I think it can enliven this book for us. Now, I talk a long time. Stop. Let's hear what you got to say. Then we can go out. Yeah, please.
Can you say something about Ched Myers, about who he is and what?
Well, I don't know a lot about who he is. He was in the Twin Cities this spring, but I was not able to attend his seminars. He was sponsored by the St. Martin's community, which John and Mary Schramm have put together in Minneapolis. John Schramm was the director of Holden Village at one time. And the institute at Augsburg College that Joel Muggy directs, which sends people to Central America and Africa and so on. There was a co-sponsorship of his coming to the cities. John Schramm has told me that Ched Myers is not a professor in a seminary or a university. He's not an academician. He's not associated himself with an institution in that way, as most scholars do. He's freelance, he's a writer, he's in process now of preparing a companion volume to this that will be published soon, I understand. He lives in Southern California, and that's about all I know.
You just mentioned yesterday, though, that he's heavily documented his approach.
This book is remarkable in its documentation. It's very clear, and it's a pretty husky volume. We spend 5 hours trying to master this book. It's impossible. And it's laborious reading at points, because he's not only stating a viewpoint, and he acknowledges very clearly it's a viewpoint, but he is arguing that viewpoint over and against the other biblical scholars. So what he has to do is continuously rehearse what other points of view have been, and then show with careful documentation the legitimacy of his own point of view. A couple of us were talking yesterday about how, well, it was Jim Oinas, the village pastor here, who knows this book well and knows Ched Myers, that it would probably be a good thing if Ched Myers could write it. An abridgment of this that would be about 30% as thick as this, for those of us who just want to hear what he's saying and not have to fuss with all the reasons why he says what he says. But this is a scholarly book, and it has that quality about it. I regret that it's not available in the village, in the bookstore, because I was given this assignment so late in the summer that I couldn't send in book orders. They wouldn't have gotten the books in time. But it is on reserve in the library if any of you would like to leaf through it. Lynn was looking at it this morning very early. Leaf through it and get some sense of it. Maybe look up a few passages and so on. You can do that. Other comments? Yeah, sure.
I was looking at chapter 10 this morning. The thing that struck me was that the disciples seem to spend a whole lot of time being amazed.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And I was wondering if that's related to this comment that you were making earlier of open your eyes and see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't have ears to hear.
Yeah.
Does the word amaze there mean, what does it mean?
It means amazed, it means astounded, it means wow, it means how can this be, bewilderment. And a nuance in that is unbelieving, you know, just not sure I agree with this. This is too much. And one of the qualities, distinctions between the Galilean section of the book and the Judean section of the book is that the Galilean ministry, and again you see this in all three of the so-called synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Galilean ministry is a public ministry. in Mark, the word crowd, I think, is used 38 times. And I just suggest, this is not from Myers, I suggest what, every time you read crowd in Mark, read masses. That is a different connotation for us. Masses means the unlearned, the hoi polloi, the common people, the ordinary folk. With all that goes with that, think of crowd psychology. Think about how easily the crowd is persuaded, how the crowd can get swept into stuff. The Twins are winning in the Metrodome. The crowd. Think crowd, masses, when you see that word. And in the early part of the gospel, it's the crowds that are amazed and wondering and bewildered. And what can this be? And isn't this the son of Joseph in one place? Isn't this the ordinary guy we saw grow up in Nazareth? How come he's saying all these things? Very first chapter in Capernaum, the very first thing that Jesus does, the very first moment in that gospel, the crowds are saying, who can this be? He speaks with authority. He doesn't sound like the scribes. Listen to that. He doesn't sound like the scribes. This is something new. We haven't heard this before. The crowds. And then the second half of the gospel, the attention is focused more on the disciples. You don't see the disciples in the early part of the book all that much. They're in and out of the story. But in the second half of the book, the disciples are center stage almost all the time. And and they're undergoing private teaching. Jesus draws the disciples together now to prepare them, if you want to think of it this way, as the future leadership of this community. This is the inner circle who's getting... I mean, this is Gospel 101. This is the graduate school. This is seminary stuff, where you bring the seminar together and you treat them with greater depth. And now it's the disciples who are not seeing, not catching, amazed, wondering, and unbelieving. And the tension, as you move through Mark, the tension between Jesus and the disciples increases. They're not drawn closer together. They're drawn farther apart. And the climax of that drawing farther apart is, of course, when the crucifixion happens and the disciples run away. They disappear. They're gone. Anybody else? Yeah.
As you mentioned, the journey to the cross was a difficult thing for the disciples to grasp because they had a vision of some messianic future. I think the church also has a difficult time with the journey to the cross because we have a glorious vision in mind, and the cross almost gets in the way. And I can see lots of things happening along the way because of that. Just look at the difficulty we have with sexuality now. If we almost feel that we've got to get all this stuff worked out. Because we want to work it out. We want to have glory on earth. Rather than understanding that this could be a sacrificial life. This is a journey to the cross.
Thank you. Very good statement. And very much in keeping with what we're talking about. And very Lutheran. You know, Martin Luther warned us about what he called the theology of glory. Triumphalism. And in part because he saw that in the church of his day, where they sold indulgences, why? To build what? St. Peter's Basilica, the largest church in the world. Who's been in Rome? Who's been in St. Peter? You walk in that magnificent church and you just go, ah! And the whole church is like a royal empire, and the Pope sits on the throne. Triumphalism. The Pope comes in, I've been there several times, the Pope comes in and all the people cheer and shout. Viva la Papa, viva la Papa. Long live the Pope. And Luther's whole sense of the church was theology of the cross. Over and over again, that's his emphasis, theology of the cross. And that's what Myers is doing. This is a marvelous textbook in the theology of the cross. Just one more thing, I won't get you, Mark. But you know the writer Douglas John Hall? Anybody know Douglas John Hall? Oh, you got to meet him. He's in process of writing a multi-volume book. The first volume is now published. And he's a professor in Toronto, and he wants to write a theology that addresses the fact that in our world the church is declining in size and influence all over the world. Certainly in the Western world. In Europe, a long time ago, nobody goes to church in Europe. All those big cathedrals are empty and such. I met, 2 summers ago, met relatives in Denmark, and my brother was with me, and he's a genealogist, and we went out and walked the cemeteries in these churches, and I asked my relatives how many people are in church on Sunday morning, and this woman said, I don't know, we never go to church. And that's sort of a typical European response. In the United States, that's happening. When I was young, the church had much more authority in our culture than it does today. We're a declining reality in our culture. And Douglas John Hall is saying, we are finally beginning to experience post-Constantine Christianity. When the emperor became a Christian, when Constantine became a Christian, then we thought we'd risen. The church has risen to its power and centrality in the Western world. And we've been living on that myth now for 1,500 years, 1,700 years. And now we're beginning to see that that's not the case. But we're not quite there yet, because the so-called mainline churches are still very worried about power and authority and afraid to risk losing acceptance by the masses, because we're not able to distinguish between what's church and what's culture. We can't find the distinction between culture, Christ and culture. Richard Niebuhr's book, Christ and Culture. We can't see any difference. Somebody one time said, the most devastating thing about church life in the United States is that you can't tell the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian. Can't tell the difference. Now, some of the sect groups understand that a lot better than mainline churches do. Those people that this summer have been demonstrating against abortion clinics in Minneapolis know what it means to hold a minority view against the majority, and to be vigorous in their commitment to that, and suffer as a result, being arrested, being maligned. I'm not saying they're right. I'm not necessarily telling you I agree with them. But that sense of urgency about who they are and being clear about their message as over and against the dominant culture is more of what we're talking about here. And what I'm saying is that the mainline churches have lost that. We don't know what our message is, except to gather more people and grow. All of us pastors, parish pastors, for years have heard from our bishops, church growth, church growth, church growth, church growth, church growth. It's ingrained into us. We've got to grow. And that's what the corporations always say. By growing, you're dying. That's a corporate model of the church. That is not what Mark's talking about. That's not what Chad Myers is talking about. Not at all. And what is the mission, what is the vision that Christ would bring to the church? That's what Myers is wrestling with in his book.
You could even say that when the church was being put to death is when it grew.
Yeah, that's right. Church has always been healthier in time of persecution. Look at the history of the church. I told our congregation that the church is in trouble church is in trouble anytime we think we have a friendly government. Just think about that. I won't elaborate on that. Just think about that. Yeah, Mari, what's your comment?
I was going to ask a bit earlier. I'm looking forward to getting a copy of that book and exploring it a bit more. But I'm wondering, when we think of disciple, we almost automatically conjure up the image of a male on Jesus. And I think one of the things that we are learning is that there are many women who are not just tangential, but who are really central and who would be called, I think, who rightly could be called disciples. Does Myers talk about the role of women in the inner circle? Because
very much
I understand that has been totally lost. It's not that there were not women there, we just have not seen them.
Well, there were women.
Yes.
And we need to catch the radicality of some of those stories in Mark. Jairus, the elder of the synagogue, big shot, comes to Jesus. What does he want Jesus to do? Heal his what? Son?
Daughter.
Heal his daughter. Jesus proceeds on the way to heal the daughter, but what happens?
A woman comes.
A woman comes up, and what's wrong with this woman? She has a constant menstrual hemorrhage. She's bleeding. Now, that's pretty bad. I don't know what that's like. Some of you women know what that's like. But in Jewish culture, it had an overlay. When a woman was in her menstrual period, she was ceremonially unclean. Bleeding was unclean. So here's a woman who is always unclean, always. She's always bleeding. And she comes and she dares to touch the rabbi's garment. She is clearly out of line. And she's healed. Jesus stops and deals with this anonymous woman. Myers says she was probably very poor because she's probably spent everything she had to try to be healed. This is a last resort for her to come to the healer, and she's healed. A woman, ceremonially unclean woman. We catch that, how radical that is. And Jesus interrupts his mission to deal with this big shot. And by the time he's dealt with the woman, what's happened to the big shot's daughter?
Died.
She's died. So then he has to deal with that, and he raises her from the dead. And then later in the gospel, we have the story of another woman, the Syrophoenician woman, came from up here, north. She's a Gentile, for goodness sakes. A Gentile? And she is clearly out of line. She is a sassy woman. She's a assertive, aggressive female. She's a feminist. And she comes, this Gentile, and what does she want Jesus to do?
Heal her child.
Heal her child, who is demon possessed. And how does Jesus respond?
Nope, you're not part of us.
He echoes the response that the rabbis are supposed to give to the Gentiles. Hey, look, you know, we ain't got no truck with folk like you. And she argues with that point of view. What does she say?
The dog even gets the crumbs off the
table. Even the dog
can
eat the crumbs from the master's table. What an assertive, aggressive, sassy woman. That she talked back to this rabbi, this Gentile woman would talk back to this rabbi. I mean, she ought to be just dismissed off stage immediately. But instead, what does Jesus do? He gives her what she asks for. And then when you get to the end of the story, and all the 12 guys, well, Judas betrays Jesus and kills himself, and Peter denies Jesus because some sexy woman gets to him over the bonfire. And all those guys take off like a bunch of rabbits. And who sticks around? The women. Women stick around. They're the ones that stay at the foot of the cross. They're the ones who on the morning after the Sabbath go out to the tomb. They're the ones that the young man at the tomb talks to and says, go tell those knuckleheads, those disciples, those guys that I gathered as a community that I thought was going to be faithful. He knew better. Those guys, tell them to get their bleeps up to Galilee, because that's where Jesus is going to be, and that's where the story is going to start all over again. And the women are amazed, right? And that's where the story's left, as far as the story of Mark is concerned. But it's the women that hang in there. And there's one other dimension of those women that Myers points out that I never thought about before. All of those women are introduced as women who apparently have no husbands. And in the ancient world, hey, if a woman didn't have a husband, she had nothing. The widow could not collect a pension, you know, or insurance, or women didn't own property. Women didn't have any kind of legal rights or legal status at all. And a single woman would be, either if a woman were widowed, she had the choice either to be a beggar or a prostitute, if she was going to make it. And here are these single women, Mary, the mother of Jesus, now widowed, and the other women, single women. It's another overlay that I've missed until reading Myers about those women. So there's a lot, Mary, there's a lot of elevation of women that's going on here. And it's, bless them, it's the feminist theologians who have pointed out all this stuff for us. We males haven't seen this over the years. We've sort of, I don't know what we've thought about those women.
We haven't.
Huh?
We haven't.
I suspect we just haven't noticed it. And probably for very good reason. Well, we had eyes and we couldn't see, and ears and couldn't hear. Yeah, right. We weren't ready. We were the bad soil in the sower parable. And caught those messages. We weren't sensitized to them in the way that feminist theologians have caused us to be. Sad fact is that there are some feminist theologians who have left the church altogether because they consider that Christianity is irredeemable from a gender-neutral standpoint, gender equality standpoint. Like Mary Daly, for example, who used to be a very active Roman Catholic. But some of the feminist theologians have said, no, we misread the story, particularly of Jesus. They don't always like Paul as well. But particularly the story of Jesus, we've misread if we don't see that Jesus was, in a very radical way, seeking equality, gender equality in society. We've missed that. Good questions, good comments. Thank you. Who else has something you'd like to say? We're near the end of this hour.
I remember reading one time that there isn't a record of any woman in the Bible being an enemy of Jesus.
Yeah, I think that's right. I can't think of any place where Jesus has anything nasty to say to a woman. I think it's also accurate to say that I don't know of any place where Jesus has anything nasty to say to anybody except the clergy of his day. People like me. And we clergy ought to kind of look at that a little carefully. The problem with the clergy of his day was that they were so sure they were right.
Just like today.
And they probably talk too much. Right? Jesus was always on the side of the people who had no power, who were marginalized, who were shoved aside by the power forces of the society. That's pretty great. That's why I told my congregation, I sometimes have a lot of trouble talking about God. I'm not sure I know how to talk about God. God is tough to talk about. And I think we talk about God too much. I think we think we know more about God than we have a right to know about God. I mean, if God is God, then God is pretty much beyond our ability to verbalize and define all the stuff theologians do all the time about God. So I want to talk about Jesus. That's what I want to talk about. Because I'm really hung up on this guy, Jesus. And I say it that way deliberately. I'm really hung up on this guy, Jesus. I think Jesus is pretty, pretty nifty. But Jesus is calling us to stuff we're not always quite ready to be and do. So our problem is not a whole lot different from the original disciples.
When you look at Jesus, isn't that God in human form?
Yeah, well, you know, okay, that's the next thing to say. And you're, you know, I agree with that statement. What we know of God, we see imaged in the person of Jesus. This is the witness of the early church. That what we know about God, we see in Jesus.
And it's not easy. He's not easy.
No. Not easy.
He shakes your tree every
day. Oh, constantly. Shakes your tree out of it.
Yeah.
Get with it, gang. Wake up. Throughout Mark, wake up. Listen. Hey, open your ears. Get the message.
And then you have that short sentence, God is love.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what Jesus images out as love.